covers the week of March 14th, 2021. Thanks for joining us this week. This program, as always, is a production of Mind's Eye Radio in Belleville, Illinois. We are still recording remotely. In fact, I think it may have been a year ago this week that we started remote recording. So thanks for sticking with us. We appreciate you listening, and we appreciate your support. My name is Bill. Thanks for joining me this week. We'll be back next week with more interesting stories from the usual suspects of sources and perhaps some new ones along the way. Stay in, stay safe, stay comfortable. Trust me, spring is coming. See you next time. Bye.
Next on Recording Library of West Texas Radio, Western Magazines, followed by the Noon Book Hour at 12.
Now, here's your forecast for the Midland, Odessa area. It's 50 and clear. Tonight, clear with a low in the low 50s. Then, tomorrow, clear with a high in the low 60s. Tomorrow night, clear with a low in the low 50s. From the Recording Library of West Texas 24-Hour Weather Center, I'm Maria Lopez.
And articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas. Your narrator is Jack.
Here are some articles from the February-March issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Photography West Galleries star lensman. Roman Lorank and Christopher Burkett are two important contemporary fine art photographers represented by one of the country's most influential galleries, by Dana Joseph. If you've ever been to Carmel in Monterey, California, you know why Clint Eastwood set up shop there. It's not just fantastic for celebrity golfers who like Pacific Ocean views with their putts. The area has long been revered by photographers, too, for its inspiring beauty, its light, its creative atmosphere, and for a certain seminal gallery that has supported their careers and the medium itself. Film photography was the most important art medium of the 20th century, said Carol Williams, owner and founder of Photography West Gallery in Carmel by the Sea. It has a tremendous amount to convey that no other artistic process can. It is such a highly sensitive medium that you can imagine you seeing something and have it mysteriously materialize in the final image. Film captures the world beyond the world. When you're eating good food, you want to get as close to the source as you can. In photography, that source is light. And light has something to say. It's a dialogue between heaven and earth at its best. I have found photography to be a very spiritual art medium, and because of that, it has tremendous visual range and an utterly unique artistic dimension. As a photographer herself, Williams would know. Her perspective comes from behind the lens and inside the gallery. Decades of spreading the gospel of fine art photography at Photography West, which celebrated 40 years in 2020. It's not even 8 a.m. in California, and Williams' daughter, Julia Christopher, is already off to a light-filled, picture-perfect day. And not just because she lives in a picture-perfect place. Christopher is the director of Photography West Gallery, one of the only, if not the only, galleries in the U.S. that exclusively show wet process photography. Carol Williams, who is the gallery's founder and my mother, was one of the first single women in the U.S. to be approved for an SBA startup loan, says Christopher. 500 people showed up at the opening in 1980. The gallery was originally envisioned as a regional cooperative founded to support contemporary local photographers, which had just happened to include masters like Ansel Adams and Brett Weston, both of whom attended our opening. Ruth Bernhardt was also alive and working, and we genuinely wanted to support her and other living photographers. We never showcased 19th century photographers for that reason. with two exceptions, Edward Weston and Imogen Cunningham, who were founding members of the famed photography collective group F64, and too important to the history of photography in the area to exclude. We wanted to support their families as well. Going into the family business as the gallery's director was a natural choice for Julia Christopher. Immersed in images and surrounded by the upper echelons of photographers and emerging talents when she was growing up, she really didn't need persuading that photography was indeed an art. The argument that convinced me that photography is a fine art medium, an argument I still use, is that when you're working in a dark room with film, blind in the dark, it's physically impossible to make the same one twice, Christopher says. She likes to use the illustration of her mother showing 10 originals of Ansel Adams' Moonrise, Hernandez, New Mexico, 1941. Carol would line them up so clients could see differences between each one. Not only is there a discernible difference from one to another that makes each photograph unique, they are also an entirely different medium from digital. I love all art mediums and have the utmost respect for contemporary digital art and graphics design, but digital is as different from photography as oil on canvas is from pastel. Photography means writing or drawing with light, literally. In order for an artwork to be a photograph, it must be made with light, just like a painting is made with paint, not pigment and printer. Christopher is careful to emphasize the distinction between the two mediums, lest photography become a lost art. I once had a college student come in the gallery and ask me which Instagram filter Christopher Burkett used, she said. At first I laughed and thought it was a joke. When I realized she was being serious, I attempted to describe film and the darkroom process, watched her eyes glaze over, and she left. Shortly thereafter, a man came into the gallery and asked if I was okay. My facial expression apparently spoke volumes. I explained what had just happened, and he said, "You're absolutely right. There's a whole generation that has no idea what photography is and thinks it's something you do with a phone." It's not that Christopher thinks that's anything wrong with digital. I love taking pictures, especially video, with my iPhone and couldn't live without it, she says. But for Christopher, Williams, and the photographers they represent at Photography West Gallery, it has always been and will always be about original photographs handmade by the artists from film using light, light-sensitive papers, and chemistry. We talked with Christopher and Williams about two outstanding contemporary photographers, Roman Laurent and Christopher Burkett. Talk to us a bit about the gallery and the two photographers you've chosen to highlight. Being a gallery founded and managed by photographers, we know firsthand how difficult it can be to receive feedback, let alone representation, from galleries. In turn, we always promise to give complimentary in-person portfolio reviews to photographers who met our prerequisites, use medium and or large format film, and do all developing and darkroom work by hand without any computers, professional labs, or third-party assistance. Both Christopher Burkett and Roman Laurent were unknown, unrepresented photographers when they walked into Photography West, Burkett in 1984 and Laurent in 1997. And after reviewing their portfolios, we decided to give them an opportunity to reach an art-buying audience. Roman Laurent is one of the most important landscape photographers on the West Coast and has turned his large view camera on the vanishing wetlands, contributing to an important and ongoing legacy of California wilderness photography. When people come into the gallery and ask, "Why is photography fine art?" I respond by showing them a series of Roman Laurent photographs, side by side. While his beautiful photographs are clearly distinctive and unique from a compositional standpoint, he also happens to be the only gallery artist who makes no effort to be consistent in the darkroom. It is physically impossible to create the same exact gelatin silver photograph twice from the same negative, but most artists will make some effort to be consistent. Roman, however, intentionally tones them differently, using a combination of sepia and or selenium chemical toners, often crops them differently, dodges and burns each one differently. And that is why I always tell clients, if you see a Laurent in the gallery you love, buy that particular piece, because it's a one-of-a-kind work, and he'll never be able to make another one quite like it. Laurent's photographs are truly unique. In addition, his invaluable contribution to the history of photography is that he expanded the West Coast photographic tradition to include California's Central Valley, which is an area no one had extensively photographed before. His most famous photograph, Private Road with Clouds, was taken in the Central Valley, and I've had multiple clients exclaim, "It reminds me of home." I found that no matter where someone is from in the southern or western United States, Texas, California, Private Road resonates with them. It has a nostalgic yet inspiring and optimistic quality about it that looks toward the future, almost like a visual representation of the American dream. What can you tell us about Christopher Birkin? Christopher Birkin is the most outstanding color photographer in America today because he combines an unerring, sophisticated sense of composition with his own innate mystical vision, while still creating each photograph by hand, using traditional darkroom materials that offer the sharpest resolution possible. His technical genius results in finished cyberchromes that are second to none. You do not view a Christopher Birkin photograph in person. You experience it. The goal of his work is not simply to take a beautiful photograph. The goal of Birkin's work is to come as close as humanly possible to recreating the physical experience of being in nature with as much integrity as possible. After experimenting with every photographic process and material, Birkin felt the particular combination of Fuji Velvia 50 and Provia 100F film with now discontinued Cyberchrome photographic paper was the truest to life, and I almost exclusively display his larger sized 30 by 30 inches to 40 by 50 inches Cyberchromes in the gallery to enhance the lifelike experience. He also refuses to use any filters on his camera when he's photographing to avoid any unnecessary distortion. People often walk in the gallery and ask me if Birkin's photographs are paintings because they're so three-dimensional. In addition to his work having a painterly three-dimensional quality, Birkin also has a painter's eye. My personal favorite Birkin photograph is an incredibly simple subject, but the composition is profoundly abstract, and I never put a wall tag on it because I love hearing visitors guess what it is. Sometimes they're 100% convinced it's the sunset on the ocean, or perhaps it's an aerial photograph of people on a beach, or an Aboriginal painting, or it looks exactly like huts on the shore of Thailand. I even had a dermatologist insist it looked like epithelial cells under a microscope. A client who purchased one of the 30 by 30 inch cyberchromes told me it was the best art purchase he ever made and the focal point of every conversation at his dinner parties. The title of the photograph is Clearwater River Ripples, Idaho. Only Christopher Birkin could turn a simple riverbed in Idaho into such a sophisticated work of art. The fact that Burkett's original cyberchromes are now also considered historical artifacts is simply an added bonus for any art collector. He is one of two people in the world that I personally know of who are currently working with this material. The machine that manufactured it has been dismantled, the paper discontinued. It is a historical process now. PBS aired a beautiful NewsHour segment about Christopher, showing and explaining his process, which you can watch on their website or on YouTube. Thank you for introducing us to the world of Burkett and Laurent. Any parting thoughts about photography? Photography is a fascinating, truly magical art medium. Christopher Burkett always says, "Photography is about extraordinary moments of light, and it is my privilege to share that light with others. Every time I walk in the gallery, I'm awestruck by the depth and luminosity of each photograph. The silver and metals in the different photographic papers, gelatin silver, cyberchrome, platinum palladium, cyanotype, etc., inherently refract light, and they literally glow on the walls. I also love discovering the differences between each photograph made from the same piece of film. I often describe film as a painter's sketch or study for a painting. The sketch is not the painting. The artwork the artist makes from the sketch is the painting, and no two paintings made from the same study are ever exactly alike. For me, the unique way an artist chooses to interpret film in the darkroom is the fine art of photography. As Ansel Adams said, you don't take a photograph, you make it.
Hi, this is Jack. I'm reading articles from the April issue of Cowboys and Indians magazine. Editor's note: Time to Get Out There, by Hunter Hawk. In this issue of CNI, we look ahead to the experiences that the peaking springtime sun permits. We'll emerge from our caves, as beautifully decorated and full of creature comforts as they might be, and turn our attentions to bolder fashion, to more adventurous travel, to nature's unending opportunities, and to the greater world outside of our bubbles. Some of us will sign up for days and nights of outdoor pursuits at one of the West's many glorious guest ranches. In this issue, we explore how new generations of dude ranchers are tending to their lands and livelihoods. Others will take the driver's seat in epic travel adventures, gathering maps, gear, and itinerary ideas that really rev up a road trip. There's a tantalizing taste of all that in our art director's personal scrapbook of a recent journey in the West. The more fashionable among us will see a new season as a chance to update the styles that signal our inner moods and personalities. You ought to know by now that CNI can help with that, cause you'll find another on-point fashion spread in our special spring and road trip themed feature. Those who stick closer to home base can still find a world of inspiration and sustenance by tending to a garden or a beautiful landscape design. Cultivating outdoor spaces has been a growing trend during the pandemic, and for good reason. An outside oasis, big or small, can feed both your spirit and your stomach. Check out some gardening and landscaping resources in the Home and Ranch section. Even if your weather's not welcoming quite yet, you can still escape to unlimited locales and states of mind via books, visual art, music, and movies. The latest to transport me is the beautifully produced indie film The World to Come, starring Casey Affleck. If you've paid attention to Affleck's body of acting work, you know he's especially attuned to communicating complicated layers of emotion and pain. Makes sense that he's already won an Oscar. His latest effort,
and the subject of our cover story concerns the inner struggles of two couples living through the harsh realities of the 19th century American frontier. The note-perfect performances stayed with me long after the closing credits, and I was thanking my lucky stars that I enjoy the comforts and privileges of modern times. We like to think of CNI as a whole soul travel guide, and of the April issue as a celebration of warmer weather and all the promise spring brings. As you flip through, we hope you'll be inspired by the people, places, and pursuits that make the American West so special, and this magazine such a pleasure to purchase. Man's best friend and protector. Dogs make great, huggable security. Just ask Wayne Simonovich, renowned trainer and breeder of award-winning German Shepherd protection dogs. By Lindsay Welkel. For thousands of years, since being domesticated from wolves, dogs have walked alongside humans as loyal companions. The term man's best friend honors the bond between human and canine, forged over time into one of the most significant animal-human pairings in history. Dogs have been our faithful companions as we've explored the world, founded countries, fought wars, started families. In the 21st century, that bond is perhaps stronger than ever. And while we may not be setting out for parts unknown quite as often as our ancestors, the need for a protective companion in today's uncertain age is as real as ever. That's where Wayne Simonovich and his protection dogs come in. The world is an uneasy place right now. "I've never seen it this bad before," says Simonovich, a renowned trainer and breeder of German Shepherd family protection dogs. Pairing one of his dogs with a family in need is a thorough process that usually takes time and expertise to develop. But sometimes an emergency situation for a family means Simonovich must match the dog quickly. "There used to be a time 20 years ago that every now and then we would have to drop what we were doing to place a dog with someone who was in immediate need," he says. "It seems like those situations that used to happen every now and then are happening every couple of weeks now. It's unfortunate, but that's why we're here." Simonovich spent his childhood years in Baltimore, but he spent summers with his grandfather in eastern Tennessee, where his grandfather trained hunting dogs. And back home in Baltimore, Simonovich's father, a small business owner, employed German Shepherds to guard the shop at night. Seeing canines excel as working dogs in the two places in the late 1960s sparked an interest in Simonovich to become a dog trainer. By the time he was in college, he'd taken a job with one of the country's top field trial trainers and had begun working with various breeds in retrieving, obedience, and protection. Soon, Simonovich homed in on his true love, developing protection and obedience skills. That focus has grown into what is now a 41-year career with dogs. Simonovich began competing rigorously in working dog competitions, and he has since earned many of the top accolades a trainer can achieve. He holds 2 North American championships, 2 national championships, and has represented the United States 7 times in the world championship competition in major cities all over Europe. His successes attracted the attention of Ralston Purina Company, which sponsored Simonovich for years as he traveled the country conducting training seminars. "Because of the successes that I had in the working dog competitions, my relationship with Ralston Purina and my ability to produce quality working dogs, I was looked upon as someone that could provide protection dog for folks who needed that. As his reputation grew, his company blossomed. I've placed a lot of neat dogs with a lot of neat people. entertainers, politicians, athletes, business people, and mostly just normal folks like you and me. More and more, customers began to seek out Simonovich's dogs as well-trained, four-legged bodyguards who could also be a part of the family, essentially huggable security, as the company tagline says. Some of these people had had bad things happen in their life. Some maybe didn't even really like dogs and never thought about having a dog, but it was their last hope for some kind of peace in their life. Once they have a dog like this, they realize how wonderful it is, Simonovich says. He has placed dogs with people who have suffered everything from stalking, kidnapping, home invasions, spousal abuse, and more. Thankfully, he says, most of his clients haven't had anything bad happen to them. They just don't want that to change. A dog can be a very determined protector if it has to be, but fortunately, those situations are rare. Most people with bad ideas, if they see someone with a strong, trained dog, they take their bad intentions elsewhere. There are three top traits in a good family dog for protection and security, Simonovich explains. You want the dog to be an alarm and wake you up in case of an intruder. You want the dog to be a strong-looking visual deterrent of an assault. And you want the dog to be committed to protecting you if the need ever presented itself. Simonovich's dogs are beautiful, but he's quick to point out that they're not show dogs. They don't jog in a circle for a blue ribbon. They're working dogs, so they've always been evaluated on their trainability, their resiliency, their determination in the protection phases, their athletic ability. Along with those qualities, he says the key trait he's after is manageability. The dog must be a manageable dog that is a good ambassador in the community and a well-mannered part of the family. Because my clients are not professional dog trainers. My clients are families just like mine and yours, and they need a dog that they can manage and that they can live with and have fun with. Simonovich and his son Jack operate their facility on 150 acres in North Carolina with a staff of 7 people who are highly skilled at training and socializing the dogs to best prepare them for their new lives. The dogs are placed in family environments where they'll go to Walmart and shopping centers, the airport, walks in public places, and experience family routines. A lot of the company's clients have ranches and acreages, so the dogs are socialized around livestock and in many other lifestyle scenarios. We've placed quite a few dogs in Manhattan, so those dogs have to understand what it's like live on the 30th floor in a high rise and walk in the park every day, so depending on where the dog goes, that's how we structure the training. For the majority of Simonovich's clients, where the need is not a dire emergency, taking time in selecting the dog right is a big priority. Getting the right dog with the right owner is a process. I need to make sure that they're getting the dog that best suits their lifestyle. That process typically takes about 30 days, and Simonovich likes to have his entire staff and his clients involved. It's paramount for us that clients are involved during the training period, but if there's an emergency, we can have the dog anywhere in the country in 48 hours or less. These days, Simonovich is focusing on his breeding program, as well as training. We are capable of producing a superior dog right now, here in North Carolina, he says. When it's done from the ground up, and I've had my hands on the dog from the ground up, I know more about what that dog's been through all his life. Judging from his many happy clients, it's clear Simonovich's formula breeds both good protection dogs and success.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm reading from past issues of True West magazine. True West, March 1999. Escape from San Quentin, Part 1. by William B. Seacrest. Hardships, growled the convict. Let me tell you, young man, nobody can conceive, nobody knows, or ever can know, what we suffered. Charlie Dorsey was describing his escape from San Quentin to a wide-eyed reporter in 1890. A murderous stage robber, Dorsey was serving a life term in California's state prison in 1887 when he met George Shinn, who was doing a 12-year stretch for an attempted train robbery. A trustee, Shinn had outside privileges. He drove a wagon hauling supplies and other materials to sites outside the walls. Well known to the gate guards, they always waved him through, usually without checking his load. Barring any unforeseen events, the two convicts planned an escape that was as simple as it was foolproof. Waiting for a stormy night in December 1887, Dorsey crawled into the bed of Shinn's wagon and threw a tarp over himself and the goods being hauled. It was black and miserable out, the rain coming down in sheets. As usual, the guards waved Shinn through, and he headed straight for the wharf. A small boat had already been selected, and the two convicts pushed off into the choppy waters. Reaching the Contra Costa shore sometime later, the two men were soaked to the skin. They hid the boat and headed east on foot. It was a trip of some days and incredible hardship. It rained all the time, Dorsey later recalled. Yet, we did not dare to build a fire to warm ourselves. We were nearly famished and ate raw vegetables and whatever we could lay our hands on. I was sick and tried to persuade Shinn to go on and look out for himself, but he wouldn't do it. Finally, reaching Benicia, the two men caught a train for Sacramento. They were free. Plunging back into a life of crime, Dorsey and Shinn were recaptured in Chicago in 1890. Shackled and despondent, the two convicts were hailed as heroes by their old cronies at San Quentin. Now, they were part of an elite tradition that was initiated almost as soon as the state prison was established. Escape was possible. With a little effort and daring, a convict could be free again. And escape they did for the next 100 years. This is the story of some of those escapes of men who would rather risk death and flogging than spend dreary, tedious years behind walls and bars. In April 1850, all county jails in California were declared by the governor to be state prisons, and the prisoners could be used on various public works. This system was quickly outmoded by inadequate local jail facilities. In early 1851, General Mariano Vallejo and a certain politician named James M. Estill promised to pay the state $130,000 in return for locating the state capitol on a piece of their property. The legislature quickly accepted the offer. They had recently learned that most eastern prisons lost money, and Vallejo and Estill's offer included the management and building of a state prison. They would also feed and clothe the convicts, in return for which they were to be able to work for them as they saw fit for their own profit. Since they had no state prison as yet, Vallejo and his partner subleased the few state prisoners to San Francisco County Sheriff Jack Hayes. Finding his own county jail inadequate, Hayes outfitted an abandoned ship, the Wabau, as a prison brig, and in mid-December of 1851, anchored it off Angel Island in San Francisco Bay. Here, the prisoners were put to work quarrying stone for the foundation of the new prison cell blocks. Hayes expected to make a good deal of money on the deal, and didn't hesitate to spend his own funds on both the Wabau and the convicts. But famous Indian fighter and Texas Ranger as he was, Hayes didn't know what he was getting into. He was soon to find out. Early on the morning of January 7th, 1852, two of the Wabau prison guards were sent to San Francisco for provisions. The other three guards brought the 12 prisoners up on deck and prepared to go ashore and begin the day's quarrying. As two of the guards supervised the lowering of the boat, they were suddenly attacked and overpowered. The third guard was seized from behind, quickly tied and thrown into a cell. As the other two guards were being tied up, some of the convicts wanted to kill them, but were dissuaded by the others. Arming themselves with muskets and pistols from the armory, the still-ironed convicts scrambled into the boat and headed for Contra Costa, across the bay. This was the first mass prison break, and posses were quickly in the field. While the authorities were notified in San Francisco, several of the prison guards, accompanied by a crew of sailors, followed the convicts closely in a whaleboat. A sheriff's posse quickly left San Francisco, while yet another group began closing in from Martinez. They were so closely pursued, noted the San Francisco Herald, as to be compelled to throw away their blankets, as there are some desperate rascals among them, and all armed either with muskets or revolvers. It is anticipated there will be some fighting before they are secured. Hemmed in on three sides, most of the convicts were recaptured without a fight. Several managed to elude the posses, however, and made their way south to San Juan, where they obtained horses and headed for Indian country. On the San Joaquin River, they crossed on Thomas J. Alsbury's ferry, then robbed and destroyed his store and ranch house. A dispatch from Fort Miller, dated January 20th, reported, Major Savage, upon hearing of these outrages, set out in pursuit of them, and by the united insertions of himself and Captain Lyons, the commander of the fort succeeded in catching the leader of the band, from whom they learned the above particulars. The major is now personally engaged in the pursuit. Major James D. Savage was a noted Indian fighter and rancher, but it is not known if he captured any of the remaining escaped convicts. Sheriff Hayes pursued his erstwhile prisoners relentlessly, and most were ultimately captured, but he must have had a foreboding feeling at this point. He had no sooner toted up his out-of-pocket expenses on extra guards, posses, and rewards when word was received in mid-May of another escape attempt on the Wabo. There were some 32 prisoners on the old brig at this time, probably the worst being one Cyrus Williamson, a 22-year-old highwayman from Ohio. He had been convicted in El Dorado County on a burglary charge, but escaped jail with a $500 price on his head. Recaptured, he was assigned to the Wabo, where he again began looking out for a means of escape. On the morning of May 15, 1852, one of the guards, a man named Hall, went below to herd the prisoners on deck with their night buckets. Unknown to him, some planks separating the cells had been removed, and a dozen convicts had gathered in one cell. Hall was unlucky enough to have opened this particular cell first. He was unarmed, but as the convicts rushed him, he kept them at bay for a short time, noted a newspaper account, by his skill in pugilism. He was quickly overwhelmed by sheer numbers and borne to the floor, but even as he called out, "Look out on deck," he seized a convict's hair and butted him fiercely. The convicts now streamed up the ladder, where they were confronted on deck by a pistol-wielding 20-year-old George Kohler, captain of the guards. As the prisoners rushed him, Kohler fired, but his weapon was turned aside by Williamson, as he exclaimed, "Damn your pistol." There was no second chance, as the exploded cap kept the cylinder from revolving. Kohler smashed a convict's face using his weapon as a club, but he was quickly mobbed as the prisoners tried to throw him overboard. Fighting desperately, Kohler was assisted by one of the prisoners, William Davis, who grabbed a boat hook and tried to drive off the attackers. When they turned on Davis, he was forced to jump into the water, but he swam to shore and alerted others, who quickly armed themselves. On the Wabo, Kohler scrambled to his feet when the other guards advanced, firing at the convicts. All was pandemonium now, as Williamson saw his chance at escape evaporating. The account in the San Francisco Herald described the action well. Cyrus Williamson broke from the rest and attempted to run down into the cabin where the arms were kept. He was slightly wounded by a shot from one of the guards and then run through the body by Hall with a bayonet, receiving a wound which proved mortal. In the confusion, Kohler received a shot in his shoulder, fired by one of his supporters, but we are glad to learn that his wound is not of a serious character. The convicts were forced before the guards, and Kohler, having now recovered and armed himself with revolvers, a final assault was made with charged bayonets upon the ruffians, and with the assistance of the reinforcements under Davis, they were forced below and secured. As they were herded below decks again, one of the convicts shouted at Kohler, "You are the damned rascal we intend to kill." But the revolt was over. Cy Williamson survived his wounds, and under the name Cyrus Skinner, served more time in prison. When the Idaho and Montana gold strikes enticed him there, he ran a saloon and acted as a fence and spy for the Henry Plummer Outlaw Band. He was lynched by the vigilantes in early 1864. Hayes, who had expended some $11,000 on his convict lease plan, now wanted out. Estelle only released him when the legislature was forced on May 1, 1852, to pass a bill providing for the construction of a state prison building. Although the original contract had provided that Vallejo and Estelle were to build the prison, the latter now whined that he had not enough time to make back any of his original costs with convict labor. On July 7, 1852, the state of California paid $10,000 for a 20-acre prison site in Marin County, across the bay from San Francisco. Angel Island was only a few miles offshore from this site, and the Wabau was now towed and anchored in a snug cove next to what was called Corta Madera, or Port Quentin, later San Quentin. The convicts were put to work leveling the ground, digging wells, and building roads, while a few outbuildings were put up for temporary use. Work gangs were sent out to San Francisco and other outlying areas as Estelle frantically tried to turn his prison into a profit-making venture. Brick-making and quarrying were still a principal operation, stone and brick being loaded on a prison schooner and sold in San Francisco. Cell blocks were a primary consideration, however, and by the summer of 1853, the first permanent building was under construction. Called the Stones because of the material used, the building was a two-story structure 180 feet long and 24 feet wide. 48 cells were upstairs, while a dormitory and offices were below. Although the number varied from month to month, by January 1854, when the Stones was completed, some 250 convicts were on hand, 150 of them still being housed on the Wabau. By this time also, a bar had been installed aboard the Wabau, while several other saloons and a boarding house and hotel were established nearby. In November 1854, a Sacramento newspaper described the growing prison site. "There is no walled area for the prisoners, numbering some 200, to be employed in during their hours of labor. The expenses of keeping them, however, amounts to $75,000 per year. The lessee employees, one guard for every 8 prisoners. The force is posted with military precision. Artillery is placed at convenient intervals, and the appearance of the ground is somewhat like a garrison, always excepting the walls. At the guardhouses, which are about 100 yards apart, horses are kept saddled, ready for immediate use. When an outbreak takes place, by previous orders, all the prisoners who wish not to be considered in throw themselves flat on the ground and thus escape being fired upon. Some of them, especially the Indians and Chinamen, enjoy the sport hugely as they escape some few hours' work by the operation. Some 50 or 60 prisoners have escaped within about 6 months, of whom more than one half have been retaken at a heavy expense to the lessee." Although no accurate tally was ever kept of the dead and wounded in escape attempts, minor affairs were almost on a daily basis. When one convict disappeared, every corner and hole was checked with no results. Finally, a snitch suggested he might be in the chimney of the steam boiler. When a fire was lighted, the victim let out a yell and came scrambling from his refuge. Another prisoner buried himself in the brick kiln and wasn't discovered until he was starved out. One convict's disappearance stirred interest in a barrel floating near the shore. A perceptive guard put a pistol shot through the barrel and wasn't surprised to hear a yell of protest as the convict quickly surfaced outside his cover. Many of the escapes were of a more subtle variety. When Thomas Foley shot and killed John Dunn, editor of the Pacific Police Gazette, he was promptly convicted and given a 3-year sentence for manslaughter. He arrived at Point San Quentin on July 1, 1854. The judge, Elkin Heidenfeld, had written a letter to Estelle asking that he show every courtesy to his newest prisoner. Either Dunn was extremely unpopular or Foley was very well liked. The terms of liberality showered on Mr. Foley must have made some of the guards at that time without uniforms and poorly paid wonder if they were on the right side. For starters, Estelle met Foley at the prison wharf. In his office, the new convict was told that he could live outside the prison at Estelle's nearby boarding house. The prison superintendent was told to allow Foley full liberty, as he never should have been convicted and would undoubtedly soon receive a pardon. As if this wasn't enough, within 2 weeks, Foley was made a guard on the night shift, given a weapon, and put on salary. But convict Foley soon grew impatient with the pardon alluded to by Mr. Estelle, and despite all the comforts of his prison life, in September he utilized his access to the prison safe by disappearing with $500 of Estelle's money. To allay criticism, when Estelle had any control over the matter, the more desperate escape attempts were often not reported. For example, in his reports, Estelle reported only 12 prisoners had been killed through 1854. A report by state prison inspectors, however, noted that more than double that number had been killed by the officers and guards in the repeated insurrections, escapes, and attempts at recapture, and their names not reported to the inspectors for fear of the trouble and expense of a legal investigation. There was no denying that escapes were epidemic in 1854. On a foggy night on May 6, 1854, four convicts cut their way through the roof of the new cell block, tied up the guard, and disappeared. On July 24, 12 convicts in a work detail at Shepherd's Cove turned on their guards and seized a small boat and made good their escape, although several were killed in the fight. And the following September, several guards were escorting 14 prisoners past a local brickyard about a mile from the prison. Apparently, friends of the convicts surprised the guards as the convicts made a break for a whaleboat that was beached close by. At least two guards and some prisoners were killed in the resulting fight, some of the prisoners escaping in the boat. Besides these more organized efforts, the convict registers also show that there were many individual escapes also. But the big break came late that year. On December 27th, a group of convicts were loading a sloop at the Marin Island Wharf, several miles from the prison. One of the prisoners was called Cherokee Bob, a Georgia gambler whose mother was an Indian. Bob had been in various shooting and cutting scrapes, but when he stole a horse in Mariposa County, he drew the stiff sentence of 10 years in the state prison. Just 21 years old at the time, Bob arrived at San Quentin on March 21, 1854. Afraid that his Georgia relations might get wind of his fate, he refused to give any name other than Cherokee Bob, and he is so listed on the prison register. His real name was Henry J. Talbot. As the prisoners were loading stone on the sloop, Cherokee Bob suddenly grabbed guard captain Ben Pullen and wrestled him aboard the ship. Another convict grabbed Pullen's rifle and opened fire on the other guards. The fight was on. Convicts in other work areas saw the fight and headed for the hills. Cherokee Bob and his cohorts now tried desperately to cast off in the sloop as the guards poured in a withering fire. Bob held the captain up in front of him as a shield, the guard sustaining several wounds. Convict John Thompson was killed as he tried to adjust the rigging at the top of the mast. The wharf was littered with wounded prisoners. As the sloop finally headed across the bay, two of the dead convicts were dumped over the side. Nearly 30 convicts were involved in the break. When the blood-splashed sloop ran up on the shore, they staggered, crawled, and ran into the brush and trees and tried desperately to hide or keep moving. The San Francisco Herald reported, Cherokee Bob was found whilst the pursuit was being carried on so lively on the hills in Contra Costa. He says Watkins was shot in the arm and another ball had passed through his lungs. He was spitting blood when they separated and was thought to be dangerously wounded. Colin Douglas was slightly wounded. Michael Hines was brought back badly shot. William Powers was badly wounded in the leg. James Smith was also found by the road, unable to proceed further in his wounded condition. Richard Berry had a few buckshot in his shoulder. The convicts robbed every ranch as they came to it, taking first the arms, their horses, saddles, clothing, and everything else they fancied. Some 21 convicts were gunshot, some quite badly. Although Cherokee Bob was reported mortally wounded and sinking rapidly, he managed to rally and claimed to have saved Captain Pullen's life. Estelle reported the hospital is filled with the dead and dying. It is a melancholy sight, but could not be avoided. Most of the escaped convicts had shaved heads and were easily recognized as they made their way towards San Jose, plundering farmhouses. Most were riding stolen horses by now. When they broke into the house of a man named Hughes, he drove them off, wounding several with shotgun blasts. After a chase and exchange of gunfire, a posse from San Jose captured six of the fugitives and housed them in the county jail. The San Jose Semi-Weekly Tribune reported, Yesterday, the gentleman who arrested the escaped prison convicts telegraphed to the officers and agents in San Francisco the fact and desired a description of the men. An answer was returned that they would not pay for the dispatch to communicate the desired intelligence. A number of our citizens made known to the agent here to inform them that they would be responsible for the expenses. Needless to say, the San Jose citizens were outraged at the attitude of the prison officials. To make matters worse, all but one of the fugitives dug their way out of the jail and disappeared. Now suppose these fellows are recaptured, railed the Tribune. Would it not be natural, altogether as a matter of course, that the nearest tree should serve as a gallows? A report in early January noted 8 had been recaptured, 4 killed, with 10 convicts still at large. It had been a bloody moment in the prison history. Prison officials hardly had time to catch their breath before Marin Island erupted again. Rather than make the trip to and from the prison grounds every day, convict work parties were housed in the old Wabow, anchored just offshore. The night of April 12, 1855 was pitch black as a howling rainstorm drenched the area. It was just the kind of night a group of the convicts were waiting for. They had smuggled a saw into a cell that butted against the side of the ship and carved out the better part of an exit. Several other cells had doorways made also, so that some 8 convicts collected in the last cell with the outside access. As the thunder roared and the convicts made the first few cuts that would open their door to the outside, they knew any guards on deck would have sought shelter. In a few minutes, the sawed-out panel was pushed out, and the convicts began squirming through the exit and dropping into the water. Collecting on shore, the convicts seized a small boat on the other side of the island and quickly pushed out into the choppy waters of the bay. Convicts John Hammond, Jim Smith, John Kelly, and Jack Bowen were all experienced sailors and had no difficulty navigating across to the Contra Costa shore, where they disappeared into the stormy night. Black Jack Bowen was a handsome highwayman from Rhode Island who spent much of his life in and out of prison. He was recaptured soon after the break, as were Jim Smith, George Wright, and John Campbell. The four other convicts made a clean getaway. Estelle and his various cohorts and partners were by this time seriously concerned about the situation. When they had originally assumed control of the state convicts, they had expected to have no more than 50 or so in their charge at any given time. By January 1855, however, they had 258 prisoners to look after, while the constant escape attempts were resulting in steadily mounting costs. There seems to be little reason to doubt that a conscious decision was now made by Estelle to get rid of some of these problems. It was later stated by a guard that whenever a lone prisoner escaped, they were not to report it, except to their immediate superior. "I will say," reported guard John Gray before an investigating committee, "that not one out of 10 of the prisoners that escape is known outside of the prison to have done so." But there was more. Estelle had decided to get rid of some of the more troublesome convicts by staging mock escapes. This was later testified to by both guards and convicts. And if this wasn't bad enough, rumor later had it that Cherokee Bob paid Estelle some $1,800 to allow him to safely escape. Guard John Gray testified that a person named Asa Estes was captain of the guard. Estes at one time paid a visit to San Francisco, and on his return, he requested me to take charge of some prisoners named Cherokee Bob, William White, Thomas Hodges, and James Stewart, and a man named Calcott, actually Corico, whom I was to take on, ostensibly to work. But according to instructions from Estes, I was to permit them to escape. At first glance, this might be the invented tale of a disgruntled employee, except that one of the convicts in on the plot, Bill White, later told the same story. "I was told by one of our guards that his captain wanted to see me at the office. I went. He told me he wanted to get rid of a portion of the prisoners then in prison. His plan was for me to take the party out ostensibly to chop wood. And when the first tree fell, we were to break and run. I was to expose myself more than the rest. The guards were to shoot blank cartridges at me." My opinion always has been that he adopted this course to make the contract system odious with the people, so he could be relieved of a bad bargain. The convicts selected for the break were Cherokee Bob Talbot, Bill Gristy, or White, a horse thief, from Placer County doing 10 years, Thomas J. Hodges from Sacramento County, another horse thief, Ned Conver, doing 3 years from San Joaquin County, Jim Smith, a highwayman and perennial escape artist, James Stewart, a murderer from Trinity County doing 10 years, and Asa Carrico. This last character had stolen some $900 from a merchant of Mariposa County, then gathered a mob and directed suspicion toward an old man. When the old fellow wouldn't confess after being strung up to a tree, Carrico had him whipped on the bare back until he was terribly lacerated. This failing, Carrico proposed putting the old man on a bed of hot coals. When the mob hesitated at such measures, Carrico suggested they start pulling out his fingernails with a bullet mold. Through all this, the old man refused to confess, and he was finally turned loose. When Carrico disappeared a few days later, he was followed by an officer who arrested him and found some of the stolen gold in his possession. He arrived at Corte Madera in August 1852 to serve a 5-year term. At noon on May 12, 1855, guard John Gray took out the five convicts into a nearby forest on a wood-chopping detail. When the break was made, Gray fired his pistol at White, but without effect. He claimed later that it was only then that he knew he was given weapons charged with blank cartridges. All of the prisoners, with the exception of Stewart, who apparently was not apprised of the plot, made a clean getaway. In time, the full import of this break was realized. Carrico disappeared, but Thomas Hodges assumed the name Tom Bell and assembled a bandit gang, utilizing Bill White, Ned Conver, and Jim Smith as the nucleus. Setting up a network of informers who advised them of robbery prospects, the gang plundered isolated merchants, teamsters, and travelers. The gang murdered a peddler in Placer County before planning a stagecoach holdup in August 1856. The attempted robbery was a terrible fiasco. The bandits were repulsed by a quick-shooting stage guard, but only after a female passenger was mortally wounded. Posses were quickly in the field, and Bell was tracked down by vigilantes who lynched him at Fire Brawl's Ferry in Fresno County. Most of the rest of his gang were captured, Bill White making an extended confession of the gang's activities. The depredations of Tom Bell's gang can be laid directly at the door of James Madison Estelle, and when various investigations explored these and many other allegations, he would finally lose his hold over the state prison. He was undoubtedly relieved to be rid of such a monumental headache when he sold the remaining years of his contract.